The R.R. Campbell Writes Cast is brought to you in part by listeners like you. Learn more about the great rewards available to Writes Cast contributors by visiting patreon.com/writescast. Thanks for listening. Happy 2017, and welcome to episode 3 of the R.R. Campbell Writes Cast. I hope everyone out there has had an opportunity to get their writing resolutions for 2017 established, and that you're feeling confident about your ability to achieve them over the course of the calendar year. If you've looked back at your 2016 goals and said, hey, you know what, I fell short in a couple places, well, that's all in the past now. 2016 is long gone, and I don't know about you, but I am very thankful for it. For this particular episode, I was joined by phone by Dylan Davis, author of stories including Detach and Canteens. His work has been featured in journals including Whiskey Paper, Fiction International, Brilliant Flash Fiction, and Driftwood Press. Over the course of the interview, we discuss flash fiction, overcoming writer fear, and the process of submitting to literary magazines. We also had an opportunity to talk about the similarities and differences in structure between short and long-form fiction. In his own work, Dylan focuses on short form with a literary bent and often incorporates elements of the surreal, something you'll have an opportunity to hear for yourself at the end of the podcast when he reads from Detach, which was published in Fiction International in 2015. And so, without further ado, I present the R.R. Campbell Writes Cast interview with short story author Dylan Davis. Thank you, Dylan Davis, for being with me.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So, kind of as I mentioned in the preamble to the podcast today, we're going to be talking a little bit about short form versus long form fiction. And you, as sort of a short story guru here for this podcast, will kind of, right, we're both the experts in this podcast, right?
You know, right.
In this
Absolutely.
World of the podcast. So we'll start then, I guess, kind of by asking you, what's your personal process like when you sit down to write a short story? You know, do you think of, is it normally like a character that comes to mind first? Is it theme? What comes to you first normally?
It's interesting because, like, it kind of depends on the length. Like, sometimes I'll set out to write flash fiction or microfiction or whatever it's called.
Yep.
Some people just call it prose poetry. But, mm-hmm. And I'll go about writing those differently than a more traditional, you know, 6 to 15 page short story.
Yeah, for sure.
Usually with flash fiction, it's a line.
Mm-hmm.
So with Detach, right? The first thing that came to mind was I asked her what it was like to have a vagina, because I was sitting. I wrote that in college, and I was sitting around in a writing class.
Yeah.
Thinking about just things to write.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of girls in my class, and I was like, this is going to sound weird, but like I looked at a girl and I was like, okay, so this is in my head. I didn't do this in class, but I wanted to ask her what it was like to have a vagina.
Right.
And then I was like, oh, that's okay. Interesting. So I wrote that down.
Yep.
And then the story got all kind of squampish from there. But when it comes to like short fiction, that I'll usually have a theme.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have a theme that I want to work with.
So it would be interesting then to say, I guess, would it be fair to say that for a short or for something more like flash fiction, like we're going to read from, you mentioned Detached, we'll get you to have a reading from that a little later. It sounds
uh-huh.
like the genesis for something like Detached, which is that flash fiction, is going to be more of a line, whereas something like Canteens, which I know you also had published at the end of, I believe that was that end of 2016 or was that in 2015 Canteens was published?
That was 2015.
That
was 2015.
It gets all muddled here, you know, at the start of a new year.
Right.
But so I mean, it sounds like when you're looking at flash fiction, it's normally like a line, like that opening line or something, like the line of impact, so to speak, is what hits you. Whereas with Canteens, maybe it is something more thematic.
Right. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. With Canteens, that was definitely different. That was a photo prompt that I'd given myself, and it was an old picture of a guy at the Golden Spike Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wanted to capture this like grainy black and white strangeness in a story. And that's where that one came from.
Yeah. Perfect. And I think that's really, you know, interesting to hear too. Cause when I try to think about, you know, just to draw the comparison between short form versus long form fiction, the interesting thing is this, like for me, I've definitely had a novel that I had this idea for, I had a concept, but it didn't really come together until I knew what the first line of it was going to be, you know? And once I had that first line, it kind of got things in motion for me. Whereas, like, for my current work in progress, it was really about, it was just kind of a concept, and the themes kind of came from that, you know? And it's not necessarily that it's a concept that's never been done before. I think the important thing that probably beginning writers need to know is that it's not about like having a unique concept. It's all about that execution, whether it comes from a line or a character idea or just an idea of an event. I think that, you know, originality is great, but it doesn't have to be the most original thing in the world to be able to put together a good story.
No, yeah, definitely not at all. I mean, I am convinced of this, that good writing is good writing. It doesn't matter whether it's original writing or not. That's why we can go and watch the same movies over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely.
And but they feel different because humans are like voyeurs naturally. I mean, we want to know what goes on in life, even in other people's lives, even if it's basically what's going on in our own life.
Yeah, and I think tying into that, I mean, even like the idea of you can see basically the same story told a few different ways. I know that there were some people that not when Rogue One came out, but the Star Wars film, I guess it would be, was it Episode 8? Everyone was like, oh, Episode 8 is basically A New Hope. I mean, it's like the same story, more or less, with the way that it evolves. But guess what? People still went to see Episode 8, and I still think Episode 8 was entertaining, even if it did, you know, draw on essentially a very similar plot to what you saw in Episode 4.
Right. Well, and, I mean, we could take this all the way back, too, because, okay, so Episode 8 is kind of like A New Hope, and A New Hope is kind of just like a build-on Jumon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a coming-of-age tale. A coming-of-age tale is just a classic story, and then we get back to the archetypes of storytelling, which is just man versus man versus nature, man versus God. So, like, I mean, you're never, ever going to escape that.
No, certainly not. Definitely not. I mean, and it comes from two, and I guess I should correct the record. It's technically, it would have been Episode 7 that came out. It would have been Episode 7, not 8. But anyway, the idea going back to just the idea of the hero's journey. Like, I think that that's something that Star Wars makes use of in every single one of its films. I mean, even in Rogue One, which is, you know, sort of an in-between, it still had, you know, there was the rallying of the troops at the beginning, you know, you meet your mentor, you become disillusioned with the mentor, etc. You know, it follows that same formula, but it still makes for great stuff, whether the idea comes from a line or a theme or whether it's original or not.
The key is that it's good writing.
Yeah.
It's a well-told, well-paced story that achieves everything it sets out to achieve, the characterization. Because it doesn't so much matter that they go and destroy the Death Star at the end. All that stuff is secondary, tertiary stuff. What matters is that there are characters that are learning to work together and learning about each other and what they like about each other and what they dislike about each other. And the Death Star is just a thing that they can go do. I mean, I seriously think that that's what it is. I mean, I think that when J.J. Abrams and his entire team and all the writers, what they set out to do was like, okay, we need to introduce the new stars of a franchise, which is, you know, Rey and Finn.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to have some familiar faces, Han and Leia. Okay,
yep.
And we need to have them interact, and what archetype should we put it to? Well, New Hope. Why not? Perfect.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that tying it back into, it didn't need to be, you know, structurally original. There didn't need to be anything in there. I think that kind of ties into something else that we were going to talk about today, which was, you mentioned as part of previous conversation that you feel flash fiction is a really great way for, you know, a starting writer to get over that writer fear. So I guess, can you kind of elaborate on what you mean by that writer fear and like what it is that makes flash fiction in particular ideal to kind of overcome that fear that someone might have?
Yeah. So this is an idea that I've kind of been playing around with for a minute, where I have a lot of friends and I have a lot of people that I talk to that they want to write. You know, I have a really good friend of mine who wants to write fantasy. What he gets upset about is that he gets, you know, 10 pages into his big epic novel, and says, oh, I don't know what to go with it. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know what to do. And sometimes I feel like he'll get really discouraged, because, how exactly do I want to put it? So, like, he'll be really discouraged because he starts a novel and then he can't finish it.
Yep.
So he's like, ah, scrap the idea. Okay. So he feels like a failure because he didn't complete something.
Yeah, exactly.
And so what I told him was, like, hey, man, instead of trying to write, you know, the next Game of Thrones, you know, 10,000-page magnum opus, just start small. Figure out how to start and complete a story. Because that's all a novel is. I mean, a novel is a collection of short stories that have an interlocking theme between them. You know, whether that be a character or themes, or I mean, if you can sit down and write 14 short stories, you now have a 14-chapter novel.
Yep, exactly.
And so the writer fear, particularly with flash fiction, and what I discovered, at least this works for me, is that when, first of all, journals don't like taking risks on unnamed writers. I mean, they will. They'll give. That's why it's so hard to get published. Because you have, and I've worked for a couple of magazines now, and you have like you have 150 pages of your magazine, and you have X amount of writers that have X amount of credentials, and you have, you know, the people that called up the writers with names and publications to their, you know, to their credit and said, hey, can we get a short story for our upcoming magazine? So you have all those people, and then you have us. You have like the regular Joe writers that love it and, you know, live to write, but we're still breaking into that scene. So what publications are more likely to take a risk on 2 pages than 12
yeah.
or 18.
Mm-hmm. Which makes sense.
Yeah, because it's like, okay, 150 pages, and then we just got this flash fiction story from some unnamed kid in Texas about a tree that, you know, grew a consciousness all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can give them 2 pages. That's fine.
And you might look at that, too, and say, you know, if you're in the position you're in at the actual magazine, you might actually love a story. It might be the coolest 12-page thing you've ever seen. But at the same time, you know, how many other people are involved in the decision-making process? And again, it comes down to that quote-unquote risk. I mean, it's strange to kind of frame it in like a risk-reward, you know, sort of scenario, but realistically, if you are a literary journal or you're a magazine that's publishing fiction, you do have a responsibility to your readership to ensure that you're putting a product out there that will, you know, is something that speaks to your mission and the interests of the readers themselves. So it's, if you can do it in 2 pages, do it in 2 pages. If you're going to take that story over a 12-pager, if you can accomplish those things, I suppose.
Right. Well, and the other thing about it, too, is like, so let's say they just accepted a 15-page story, and then you send your 15-page story in. Well, sometimes they'll look at it and they'll go, "Oh, we already have
a big one,
15-pager. We need to, you know, we kind of need some to break up." And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that you sent your story in a day late.
Yeah, it's about saturation to a point too, because how many 15-page stories do they want to throw in there if, you know, the readership is actively looking for something that's more on the flash side, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And so the writer fear is like, and then there's the next level of writer fear, which is actually getting the courage to send your stuff out.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, if you get a flash fiction piece rejected, it's okay. I mean, it's not like you're not going to die if you got 700 words rejected. It's definitely different than a novel. You know what I mean? Like, this is a novel that you worked on for years.
Yeah, it's a very different thing. And I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. You know, talking about, you can write 700 up to, I mean, would you consider flash fiction up to maybe 2,000 words kind of thing?
Yeah.
Seems like kind of silly.
Yeah,
I mean,
2,000, but.
Yeah, so I mean, you have 700 to 2,000 words. That could be, you know, an afternoon worth of work to get down a first draft compared to, you know, your friend who's trying to write that fantasy novel who makes it 10,000 words in and it falls apart on him. So I think that is good advice. I think that's something, especially if you're an individual who has an idea for a novel, but you're not quite sure how to like make it come together yet.
Yeah.
Using flash fiction seems like it would be a really good platform. And I guess if you are an individual who's very set on knowing that like you need to write it as a novel, maybe it's just about framing it differently too. You know, it's not about, can I get all the way to the end? Maybe it's, can I write a quality scene here to get me going? Like giving yourself those checkpoints along the way to make it feel like less of a failure if you don't make it all the way to writing end on the last page of your manuscript, you know?
Right.
So
well, I heard a great quote from Antonia Nelson. She's a brilliant writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm probably butchering it, but there's a quote somewhere about where she said she starts everything as a flash fiction. I mean, every single piece she writes, it starts as a flash. And then if it needs to be told longer, then it goes to a short story. And if it needs to be told longer, then it goes to a novella. And if it needs to be told longer, then it's a novel.
Yeah, I mean,
she's always looking to end her story.
And that's actually really interesting that you say that, because that came up for me earlier today at my writer's group. With a writer who is running his novel through the group right now, we had, I think, 3 chapters that we saw from him today. And one of the things we were talking about was, you know, really streamlining the scenes, kind of tightening it up. And he kind of confessed that though he really sees this as a novel, he feels like sometimes he's just writing to get that word count up. And I kind of had to tell him, you know, which I think he knew, is one of those things that's like you can't write words just to have the words. You know, you got to have a purpose with them. You got to have really, I think of it as like strong word economy, where every word is really, it packs the punch that it needs to pack. And it's not just there for fluff.
Right. Absolutely.
And I kind of gave him this example, and it's nice that you kind of threw that quote out there too, or that example of, for my current work in progress, it started as a short story. It was like just an idea. I wrote down, you know, a couple thoughts on it. It might have been on a, you know, napkin or in my little notebook that I was keeping at the time. And then I wrote it as a short story. From there, I said, hey, you know, it would be cool. Maybe we'll add another perspective character to this. And it kind of blossomed from there into, you know, a couple drafts ago, it was up at like 565 pages, and I'm now in the brutal process of like shaving 200 from that. But you know, it is what it is. You got, yeah, it's, yeah. It was like 100. And the draft I finished, I think last year, hit 165,000 words, and I was like, well, it is sci-fi, but also still not acceptable. So I'm trying to really.
Right.
I think I can get around 120, but it's a project. So hey, but that goes to show you, like, start small. Let it grow, and then maybe it grows to be more than it needs to be, and you gotta, you know, trim the hedges, so to speak. It's all about the process as it evolves, I guess.
Right, well, you know, it's just so funny that for some reason in writing, we tend to think that it's, like, not part of any other thing in life, like, but it is. I mean, with everything, you want to start small. If you want to get into farming, you don't immediately, if you've never farmed in your life, you don't immediately go to Monsanto and say, can I have $1 billion in all of your seeds?
Yep.
Like, you start with a little garden plot, and you go, okay, I really liked this a lot. and that's, I mean, the same can be said for writing. And I think that's really interesting that you brought that up about, I think you actually had an example of going that far, and this going that far with a short story all the way to a 500.
Yeah, it blew up on me. I was trying to do too much, and I need to, I had all these thoughts of like, oh, you know, I need to establish a precedent, because I see it as like ultimately being part of a trilogy. It has that potential. So I was like, oh, I need to sow the seeds of the second book throughout the first one, which it's like, yeah, you do, but like, don't shove it down its throat either. Like, it's got to have room to breathe on its own. So.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you're writing a story, a good story, you do want it to be a standalone.
Yep.
You want it to be a standalone that also could have more.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's, as I've kind of looked into, you know, you mentioned the process of trying to submit to journals and things of that nature with your flash fiction. As I've done, because I've pitched novels before. I've done some querying with past like work, but I really wanted to do it quote unquote right this time. And the research that I've been doing does say, like, even if you know you think you might write a trilogy by the time it's all said and done, when you pitch it, you really have to pitch it as a standalone. And that only makes sense, because everything should be able to have its own 2 feet, so to speak.
Right. Well, I mean, especially when you have a novel, you have a publication or an agent that's purely looking at marketability.
Yep.
I mean,
and that's the cold reality of it, really. That is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they get things done because that's, you know, that's their mentality.
Yep. And if you're an agent too, I mean, you're not getting paid unless you get something published. So it's easier to take a risk on your own paycheck if you've got a standalone versus I have an unpublished author who wants to write a 10-book series, you know, and it has to be written as a 10-book series, because that's all going to take many years to get through. So.
Right. Well, I'm looking at the same thing right now, because I have a collection of short stories. I mean, I have what would be considered a collection of short stories now. I need to get more of them published, because that's kind of how it works.
Yep.
But there is nothing harder, I think, in the industry than getting a collection of short stories published
as a
first time.
Yeah.
because nobody buys them. So,
well, yeah, it's a tough thing to do. I mean, I think about even, you know, as independent publishing, whether it's through Amazon or like indie presses, has become a bigger thing. Even I've written, I think it was like last year, over the course of a couple of years, I had a collection of short stories that all followed the same sort of character, and I was like, oh, this would be really cool to put out there. But also, I felt like I would even have to market. I felt like I would have to market it as a novella to get any traction, because it is tough to kind of push a collection of short stories through, you know.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. I'm sitting on about 50,000 words of short stories over the course of like years of short story writing.
Yeah.
And I have four of them published, so gotta up that to like all of them, preferably.
Yeah, but, right. You don't want to leave anyone behind.
Yeah, well, I mean, that short story writing, you'll never make money off short story writing. You'll die poor. But you used to be able to. That's how Fitzgerald made his money. But
yeah,
like,
right. Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to short story writing, that all pays dividends elsewhere. I mean, if you want to, you're never going to make a dollar off of going to a magazine, giving them your short story. I mean, they just don't have the money.
Yeah.
And you'll never get in the New Yorker. I mean, you will maybe, but you won't.
And even if you do, I mean, realistically, again, like, number one, I think, you know, it's great if you get into writing and you think you're going to make a ton of cash, but realistically, I think the people that get into this, whether it's a hobby or they want to take it as something more serious, I should say, if you're in it to make a couple bucks or to like make, you know, buku bucks, those are the people that don't end up sticking with it either. You know, like
everything
is sort of, whether you're writing, I think, short stories and getting them published, you know, one at a time and that sort of grind with the idea of getting a collection out there. Or if you're, you know, me who's sitting here and trying to crank out draft after draft of a novel to eventually get it published, it's like, that's just an investment. And even if you get, you know, you hear stories of novelists that get published for the first time, who say, even if they had an agent, even if they had a publishing house, based on the time they invested and based on what they have to invest financially and making sure that it gets off the ground, you maybe break even. So, like, you have to love it. Like, that's the point. Like,
right.
That's why you need to sit down and do it, because you love to do it.
Yeah. I mean, it almost seems trivially true to us, and I'm sure a lot of writers, it seems trivially true, but it is. I mean, that is the truest thing about writing, is that if you're getting into it to be successful, You shouldn't have any goals to be published.
Yeah.
You should have goals to be right or making money or anything.
Yeah.
You should have, if your writer goals should be write the best thing that you've ever written.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep.
And everything else can fall under that umbrella. Everything else can be under that umbrella of write the best thing you possibly can.
Yep.
If you write the best thing you possibly can, guess what? It usually means that you can get it published.
Yep.
Because
if
so,
you're writing
yeah.
with, it's like writing with audience in mind. Like, I think I might have mentioned this as maybe in a previous podcast, or I mentioned it somewhere on my blog about like the writer who goes to a conference to learn about like what's hot in the industry, because they want to be able to, like, you know, ride that wave real quick. And it's like, well, okay, be realistic here. You're going to sit down and write, you know, another rehashed like teen vampire novel. And where's that going to get you by the time you get it published? One, it might not be
right.
a story you're best suited to tell. And two, if you're trying to catch waves and things of that nature all the time, you're going to miss them. It takes a long time to write a book, to get it together, to find an agent, for that agent to work with a publisher and secure a contract. Like, you just have to write the story you're meant to tell, and you have to write it in the best way that you can, and everything else should just come together. You know?
Right.
So.
Yeah, and sometimes it doesn't.
Sometimes it doesn't. Once in a while, you write something you're really proud of, and then you look at it years later, and it turns out it looks like, you know, macaroni glued to a piece of loose leaf. It's not exactly what you thought it was. So, but
yeah,
I guess, like,
yeah, I've gone back and looked at some of my short stories.
Yeah, it can be tough. I was even looking at, and I'm saying this knowing that this podcast is going to end up posted on my blog, but I actually last night I went back and looked at some of my first blog posts, and I was a total just like, oh my god, it was amazing. Like, wide-eyed, bushy tailed, I was ready to go. I had like this weird. You know, I don't know if on Reddit you're familiar with the I Am Very Smart subreddit by
yeah,
any chance.
Yeah.
Oh god. I definitely had like a couple things like that laced in there, and it was like, oh man, I was a little insufferable. I'm hoping I've improved on that. So
it happens. It happens.
Yeah, we've all been there.
You bringing that up is just, it's reminding me of all of the things that I do on a on a day-to-day basis.
That's all right. You know, all we can do is write the best thing we can and hope to improve as people and writers every day, right? You know?
Right.
That's what we tell ourselves anyway. That's what we tell ourselves.
Well, and also, oh, sorry, I keep cutting you off. I mean, with you saying that, you know, be the best people and be the best writers that we can every day, studying everything about writing is good, right? I mean, studying everything about life is good. Because it all comes back to your writing. If you're nervous that you haven't, you know, written anything in a while, but you've been working really hard at your job or whatever you're doing, then you'll probably come back to your writing and have this new idea of like, oh, that's a really cool theme of working really hard. I kind of want to work with that working really hard theme because you were just in it. So that was the only thing I was trying to say.
No, and that makes perfect sense. I mean, it's all about, there's that mantra of writing what you know. I mean, and that kind of happens naturally anyway, but the more, I guess, you can write about things that are true to your own experience or true to your own interpretations of maybe other people's experiences, the better quality writing you're going to come out with, you know, just because it is something you've lived, it's something you've breathed, and it should kind of work itself out naturally in that way. So looking, I guess, at sort of a structural thing again, kind of tying it back into Flash, you know, when I sit down to write, I guess more when I sit down to outline a novel, once I'm at the point of outlining it scene by scene, I always use this same goal, conflict, resolution, cliffhanger sort of outline for the chapters. And I guess I'm kind of curious to know, is there a structure? Because I feel like, to me, when I think of Flash fiction anyway, and I'm no expert on it, but I think about it as, you know, it's always just like an impactful moment. You get a glimpse of an impactful moment. And I just kind of wonder, you know, is there an underlying structure that you feel either you introduce into your own Flash fiction or something that you kind of see come up a lot as you're reading the Flash fiction of others that might be similar to that structure I was just talking about?
Yeah. When I read this question a couple days ago, maybe a week ago, I thought that was a pretty interesting way that you go about doing that, because, I mean, like I was saying at the beginning of the podcast, there's a couple different names for Flash fiction, right? There's microfiction, there's short fiction, there's Flash fiction, there's prose poetry, and they all have their own kind of unique feel to them, in my opinion. Like, my preference is to call it Flash fiction, and the reason why is because it is a flash, you know what I mean? Like, it's here and gone in a flash kind of thing, but it's also like a flash of light. Like, you're getting punched right from the get-go. This is my theory on it. That's why the story starts with such a, where White Detach starts with such a strong opening line, is because I really need you to pay attention.
It's like throwing, you know, in a novel kind of analog way, it's that inciting incident, but you have to pack it into like 15 words or less or something like that, you know, to really get a reader in it right away.
And so, because you have so little to work with, you're usually only going to be able to have one scene. I mean, it depends. You could go read like some of the, I have a couple of collections of Flash fiction at my house, in my library, that are like, they are 100 Flash fiction pieces in each of them. And the stuff that some of those guys can do, like a David Foster Wallace Flash fiction piece, I don't even understand it. I mean, he captures an entire life in like 400 words.
That's crazy to me, especially when you mention him specifically, because of course I think of like Infinite Jest right away, which is like, you know, five times the length of the Bible, and, you know, just a complete, it's a tome and a half, so that's interesting that I didn't know he did a bunch of Flash. I didn't know that.
I don't know if he's done a bunch of Flash. I know he's done one Flash, one of my books, but sure. I haven't read any of his other Flash, but a bunch of his short stories.
Have to try and dig that up.
Infinite Jest.
Yeah.
Failed every time I tried to read that, but yeah, and so he captures this like trailer park life in a couple hundred words, and it's awesome. I mean, it's an amazing short story. But it's not what I would do with Flash fiction. I guess I just don't have that. I don't have that idea when it comes to Flash fiction. I want a very impactful scene that means something, and so when somebody comes to it, they know exactly what they're taking away from it. Maybe not right at the beginning, but definitely at the end, they know what they're taking away from it. They know what I was trying to say.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the things that, like, I really appreciate about Detach, which, again, Dylan is going to read that to us at the end here, so you'll get a chance to actually hear it. One of the things I really did like about it is that it definitely drew me in right away. I mean, you pack that punch in the first line, and then by the time it's said and done, I mean, that's the piece of the ones that, you know, you gave me an opportunity to read. That's the one that's kind of stuck with me most. And I guess maybe we should save our conversation about that one specifically for maybe after the story, just so listeners have a chance to have heard it too. But I do think that that's a really good example of what you can pack into few hundred words, so to speak. I guess I don't know what the word count is specifically for that one, but I mean, it's just a scene. So it'll be neat to maybe revisit some of those ideas once we've had a chance to listen to that.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think we've kind of talked a little bit about how the getting published in the world of Flash and in the world of short stories kind of works, but I guess for you then, how do you pick and choose the journals or magazines that you are looking to submit to? You know, is there a sort of repository, like a grand place that's going to keep track of all this information for someone who's maybe looking to submit? Or are there a few, like, journals or magazines that you follow actively, and those are ones that you choose to submit? How does that kind of work
for you? It's all Duotrope. I love that website.
Yeah, I've heard about that one too.
Yeah, Duotrope is probably, at least for a short story writer, it is the best resource available. Like, I cannot praise them enough for what they do and how comprehensive that website is. I mean, there's other ones, right? There's New Pages, there's poetsandwriters.org. They, in my opinion, they don't capture everything that I love about Duotrope. They have pieces of it. But Duotrope is everything. I mean, you can track your stories, you can track how long they've been out, you can track where they're at. Every magazine. It used to be rude to do simultaneous submissions, right? Submit to more than one magazine.
Yep.
That's totally changed with the advent of the internet. I mean, unless you're submitting to the Sun, even the New Yorker's all right with it. Yeah. So when you're shotgunning your submissions, shotgunning is probably not a good term for it.
But I know what you mean. I mean, it's kind of like the, you know, again, here we are using a weapons metaphor, but it's like the spray and pray. Like, you're going to submit it everywhere and hope that it lands in the right hands, you know?
Yeah, I want to advise against just spray and pray. I mean, you do kind of want to have selections in mind, and I'll get to that with how I pick in Duotrope. But so with Duotrope, You have this gigantic database of, like, I swear, every journal on Earth. I could be wrong, but I swear it seemed like it, because I've been going to that website since I was 17.
Oh, dang.
And I'm still finding new magazines.
That's awesome.
And you can filter the criteria down so much. Like, okay, I have a 1,000 word short story that is slightly mature, bizarro, dark fantasy story.
Right, so it's a very unique thing, yeah.
Yeah, it will find magazines based on that criteria.
That's amazing.
I mean, it's $5 a month, which is a cup of coffee, so.
Yeah, which is great, actually, because I know that was going to be one of my follow-ups, was that I have heard of Duotrope. Like, it's been thrown around at conferences I've been to and in, you know, casual conversation with other short story writers, but I did recall that it is a pay sort of thing, but you said it's like a cup of coffee, right?
Right. Yeah. It's a cup of coffee a month.
Yeah. Makes it more than worth it if you're actively writing and looking to submit, I am sure. Because, I mean, it sounds like the resource, you know, like it's the place. Yeah.
To me, it's the definitive resource, because not only can you see all of your pieces, but you can also review their statistics based on people's reporting.
Oh, that's cool.
So, like, you can look at a magazine's statistics. Like, there's a list on there that's the most approachable markets.
Yeah, for, like, what's the most greatest acceptance rate, for example.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got Not Behind the Dock published.
Yeah.
I was literally looking through the top 10 most approachable, and then I found a magazine called Whiskey Paper, and I went and read their stuff, and I was like, oh boy, this is cool.
Nice.
And then I submitted to them, and they accepted within the day.
Oh, wow. Which is pretty crazy. Dang, yeah. That's really cool. Was that, like, near the deadline that they had, or were they kind of like a rolling submissions kind of?
They're rolling.
Oh, okay.
I remember they're rolling.
Well, that's very cool.
They kind of just do it as they get it. But yeah, they're great people. I highly recommend everybody to go read Whiskey Paper, not because I'm published there, but just because I love those two. They're so cool.
Yeah, and that's, I'll just mention too, like, for those listening, I'm going to go ahead, and when I post this, I will make sure to put some links up for the stories that are available, as well as for the presses or, say, magazines and journals that you were published through, just so that, you know, listeners have an opportunity to check those ones out specifically, because obviously they were working with you, and they were seem like they're all legit places and awesome to publish with. So put that up as a resource for listeners too.
Yeah, definitely. And so then I'll jump over to the next phase for publishing, and I kind of already touched on it.
Mm-hmm.
But so when I'm looking around through Duotrope, I look at their statistics, I look at their names. Names are big to me. Like, I really like the name Whiskey Paper.
Yeah.
It says a lot about the guys that run it. You know
yeah.
what I mean? Driftwood. I really like the name Driftwood.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when something catches my eye and the statistics seem right and, you know, they're actually responding to people, because sometimes you get on Duotrope and you find out that a magazine has basically been defunct,
mm-hmm.
which happens. But so if the statistics line up and everything's right, then I go to their website. And that's kind of a field thing. Is like, do they put a lot of work into their website? If they don't, is it because they're primarily a print magazine and they don't really have a web presence? Because there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if I wanted to go get published in Colorado State was a good one. I can't remember what it's called, but I think it's just called like Colorado Review.
Mm-hmm.
But their website, it's not a good example. PlushShares, there you go, PlushShares. PlushShares is a horrible website. PlushShares is also one of the best places to get published.
Yep.
I mean, PlushShares is like a career maker. So,
I suppose it's kind of like, it all depends on what you're looking for. You know, it's about doing that additional research, where if a website, for example, turns you off, it's like, well, take another look at them. You know, that's something that I think a lot of universities, even as they've tried to bring in, you know, the best talent to their schools, they've had to, especially over the course of the last however many years, you got to have a good website now, you know, especially for a generation that's like, has only known computers. They've only grown up with cell phones around. Like, that's a really big deal. So it's kind of, you got to do that background research too, because otherwise you're going to pass on a place like PubShares, which could be a great opportunity for someone, for example.
Right. Well, yeah. And it's also, you know, it kind of depends on the piece too. So if I'm looking at one of my pieces, I'm just trying to think of one. Fish Face, which is one that you didn't see, but mm-hmm. Fish Face was a story I was shopping around for a while, and I thought that it was going to hit harder. It was going to not hit harder, but it was going to be more interesting to a demographic that's like over 30.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking, okay, well, now I gotta find magazines that
are kind of tailored to that.
The aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean, that's all part of putting in your research. It's just like, if you're going to start querying agents with your manuscript for a novel, you can't just send it out to every agent whose email address you find. You know, it's about,
totally.
Yeah, you got to know the genre they're looking for, whether they're currently accepting. You have to format it according to what their, you know, preferences are. Because if you don't do those things, I mean, you're just, I don't know, don't waste your time. You got to do it right. You want to make sure you're investing that time wisely, I guess.
And don't make a bad name for yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, don't, if the agent doesn't publish fantasy, do not send them fantasy.
Yeah, because they're simply,
they don't want to see it.
And that's nothing against fantasy for them. It's just not what they're looking to work with right now. Like, you don't, I don't know, you could have a friend who's an agent and you could be best friends and they could really love your work, but if like they're not working with publishers, or if they're not in an agency that's interested in publishing your genre, that doesn't mean they can just like do you a favor. And that's assuming you know the person, you know?
Definitely not. So. That's like 101.
Yeah.
Do not send it to people who don't want to see it.
Yep, definitely. Cool. Well, then I think one of the last things I wanted to kind of hop into here, taking it a slightly different direction before we have you read from your from some flash fiction of your own, is talking about sort of the difference between writing literary fiction versus genre fiction. Because I know based on previous conversation, you tend to write you prefer to write with a little bit more of a literary bent, you know, focusing on theme or character development, things of that nature, as opposed to kind of what I end up doing naturally, which is I'm writing a techno thriller, or it's within the bounds of sci-fi or what have you. So what is it that pulls you personally toward writing literary fiction as opposed to genre fiction. And have you ever worked with genre fiction, I guess?
I'm taking my first foray into writing fantasy since I was a kid.
Oh, cool.
Right now. Mm-hmm. I'm not like working seriously super hard on it.
Yeah.
But I am kind of writing with it, and mostly to teach myself some stuff, because mm-hmm. I feel like where I'm lacking right now in my writing is characterization. And I've been talking about this a lot recently, where, I mean, I think every writer should probably try and write everything. Mm-hmm. When you look at, like, Margaret Atwood, she writes everything. I mean,
yeah,
she writes sci-fi,
yep.
Literary fiction, short stories, novels.
She's got poetry out there. Like, I stumbled into her as a poet first, honestly. And I don't even know, like, what got me finding that before I found any of her novels. But I have a collection of books of poetry from her before I even realized, like, holy cow, she's got all of this other material out there. And I actually, it's funny you use her as an example, because I literally just got in the mail this week from Amazon. I got Oryx and Crake, so I'm really excited to start.
Oh, really?
But yeah, I mean, she's a really good example of exactly what you're speaking to, which is like, write a little bit of everything and find what works for you, because you never know like what direction you could grow in.
Yeah, definitely. And the reason why I've written with a literary bent for as long as I have, I started writing science fiction when I was a kid, because I was just like, I didn't know what I was doing. That was what I was watching, was, you know, science fiction.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I love Star Wars, so I was trying to write that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But when I, as I was getting older, I started getting into philosophy, and like, and this sounds very arrogant and annoying, but
I am very smart. We're bringing it back to that.
Yeah, I am very smart. It's not that because I got into philosophy suddenly, like, I'm writing literary fiction.
Yeah,
but, like,
right.
My taste did change. I just around sci-fi as much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't watching fantasy very much, and so what I was reading was novels about, you know, I was reading like Hemingway and everything.
Yep. No, we've all been there. I get it.
And but what I discovered is that I really like it. I mean,
yep.
I really like stories about real people. And
yep.
Action to me isn't so important anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I'm writing fantasy, it's becoming more important again. But I'm not. And also, I do want to say, I'm not talking down on any of them, because I think they all have their merits, and I think they're all good.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But for me, specifically, I was really trying to get into, like, the absurdist writing, because I wanted to explore, like, different ideas. I had this wild hair up my ass at one point, where I was trying to figure out a way. I was so stupid, I was a teenager. I was trying to figure out a way to write. You know how, going back to what we were talking about earlier with the man versus man and all
yep.
those story archetypes,
mm-hmm.
I was trying to find another one, like, you know, like I'd be the dude that did it, which obviously I wouldn't, but, and so I was just kind of following that train for a long time. I was just following that path of, like, bizarro-ness and absurdity and, you know, experimental stuff.
Yep.
And the reason why I like that is, I think, probably just comfort, really.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm getting into the fantasy, though, one of the things that I've noticed that's really interesting is, so the hard part of fantasy is world building.
Yeah.
Sci-fi and fantasy
absolutely.
Is world building, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's the most difficult part, is coming up with a cohesive lore
mm-hmm.
that fits and the magic makes sense and, you know, and it's consistent. That's
yep.
that's a really hard part about writing fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
What's really hard about writing literary fiction is characters. That's the hardest part about writing characters. That's the hardest part about writing that fiction, is characters. That's what I've learned recently. Because fantasy, it seems like it's, at least in my experience, it doesn't seem like it's as hard, because you can kind of just make the characters whatever you want them to be, so long as it's consistent with the really hard part, which is the lore.
Yep.
Whereas, if you're writing literary fiction, you have the world built for you. You have our world, right?
Yep.
You have Joe Blow driving in his car, going around. And so how do you make that guy interesting? How do you give that dude something that gives everybody a reason to continue to read him?
Yeah, he has to have a depth that is very true. He has to feel, and this is going to sound weird because we're talking about it in the context of like a person, but like, when it's literary fiction, it's like the people have to feel lived in, whereas if you're writing, you know, fantasy or sci-fi specifically, the world has to feel lived in.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And so that's why I've switched over to writing fantasy, because I want to I want to learn more about characterization because I haven't really taken any experimentation recently, at least with, mm-hmm. with characterization, in my literary stuff. It's mostly just like, okay, I need to assign these traits. I let the characters breathe usually, yeah. like in their own. I let them do things. Like if the character suddenly wants to have a dead mother, then he has a dead mother. But yep. like,
and that's all part of that like first draft exploration. Like honestly, when you're writing a first draft of a novel, especially if you're doing like a genre based thing, in my experience, it's like you just have to shed this idea that what you're writing, like any of the words you're writing, are somehow going to make a final draft, because you know what, they're probably not. Like you just have to let the characters do their thing and explore the world in that first draft, and like if you make it all the way to the end and like you've covered the grounds of your general plot, great job, now you've got something you can work with, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Anne Hood, I studied with this one writer, I'm like name dropping and annoying, but she's a brilliant writer. Mm-hmm. I love Anne Hood, she's awesome. I highly recommend reading all of her stuff, especially The Obituary Writer. That's mm-hmm. a beautiful novel about women and pregnancy. I love mm-hmm. it. But so I was studying with her, and she was talking about how first drafts are the most fun.
Yeah, because it's just fun. Caution to the wind, whatever. Just write stuff yeah. down. Yeah.
Write whatever you want. Yeah. I mean, anything, it doesn't matter. This is part of the thing. I actually thought it was interesting when you talked about outlines.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't outline short stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that they're a totally different style of writing, novel and short story. But to me, and this is part of the thing that's been a struggle for me switching over to that fantasy realm, is that I'm not outlining it because I've never developed that skill. I never yeah. developed the skill of outlining. And I've had philosophical differences with it because I've never really liked, I don't like boxing myself in and saying, okay, by this point, which character should be this. Because mm-hmm. I don't think that that's how characterization or anything should work.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's when characters start to sound contrived. So I thought that was really interesting that you're, because I know that most writers do it. Most writers do outline, especially novelists. And yeah. so I guess I was just curious, like, your opinion on the outline.
Yeah, and actually, I kind of can tie that into some of the other things you were talking about with, like, you know, coming from a literary background where maybe world building's been more of a struggle, or like it's a different kind of characterization that you have to do for the characters. I've actually, over the course of maybe the last like 4 to 5 weeks, I've been doing a series of blog posts that are about, you know, what my process is when I sit down. Like I have an idea for a novel. I try to like slowly build it up to get to the point of outlining, you know? So like what I do first is I'll try to come up with that log line first, you know, that's your one sentence that you have to describe the action of the entire novel. And then from there, I start to kind of think more about, okay, I have my main character now. How do I need to make them a real vivid person? How do I need to make all of my, you know, all of the supporting cast real vivid people that could support right. this kind of story, so that by the time I'm getting down to getting an outline together that is, you know, the 7 quote-unquote story elements, so to speak, that underlie any story, I have something to work with. But then once I throw the characters in there, once I have them characterized, once I've written, I might write some short stories from a character's perspective first that's kind of outside the bounds of the novel, then I can sit down and say, all right, I have a feel for like what it is to be this particular perspective character or what it is to be a supporting cast member. Now I can sit down and say, these are the 7 major points that I have over the course of the story. What can I put in for connective tissue, and how can I outline these scenes in such a way that it'll remain true to the characters that I've created? Because I think kind of like what you were saying, the last thing you want to do is have some characters that you as the writer are trying to shoehorn into situations against the character's will or against who they are as people. You know, it has to be told. You're going to have a narrative voice inevitably as part of what you're writing, but the characters need to be telling that story. And that's why if I'm going to be outlining a novel, I better have my characters figured out first, and I better know them really well. Because I've run myself into that trap before where it's like, oh, I have this really cool concept for a story. You know, if I start with concept and I just start writing it with like, well, I'll just throw in a character here, I'll throw in a character there, that's when I end up getting reviews that are like, okay, well, that didn't really make any sense because that seems contrary to that character's views as they were expressed in like a previous chapter. So it's really outlining is great. I have to outline, especially when I'm doing like multi-perspective storytelling, but
yeah.
I have to know my characters first. You know, you got to start, that's got to be your starting point, I think.
That's really interesting. It's really interesting to say that. I mean, I guess it kind of just shows the different backgrounds and what you spend more time in, because I don't really do that when it comes to writing.
Yeah, and I think it just comes from, like, the standpoint of, you know, we come at it with, like, different, I think, maybe goals in mind, and I think that's one of the things that makes it really interesting, is that at the end
totally,
of the day, the goal is to tell a quality story, something that a reader can step away from with, you know, their own thoughts and interpretations on, but it's about the emphasis points and the amount of space that you allot yourself to tell, or to get those ideas across, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, there's definitely not one better way than another at all. I mean, every writer is going to develop their own, but it's interesting for me personally. I'm like thinking about a fantasy piece now, because I suppose I am doing. I have like somewhat of a loose mental outline,
mm-hmm.
And there's another thing that I kind of do that's I like to call them plot points.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where it's just like, and maybe that's the term, I don't know, but because I probably picked it up from some website or something. But where like I kind of just write down a bunch of ideas every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do this with every story. Some stories call for it, some of them don't. But like I have a note somewhere on my computer that makes me laugh because it's from a dead story that I haven't touched in a long time. But it's an idea, and it says finds a disassembled instrument in a dumpster, and it's just like it's such a weird.
Yeah,
like, it's like one. It's a document. It's a Word document that just has that.
Yep.
It's the only thing that's on the document, and I won't delete it because
you
want to
use
like
that as a prompt. You know,
yeah. Yeah, this one weird thing that like I want to figure out what to do with it. But yeah, and that's the kind of thing that I'll do.
Yeah, and that's...
Is that outlining? I mean, I don't really know.
I mean,
if that's
it's giving yourself a direction. I think, like, outlining is going to be what it's going to be for different people, you know? Like, I know
yeah,
that there's
sure.
folks, you see it a lot, I guess, on Twitter if you hang out on there, like, especially in the lead-up to NaNoWriMo, is, like, people who, they fret over having, an outline ready to go by November 1st so that they're ready to go to town and just, like, trust themselves through the outline well. But then there's other people... And I call them pantsers because they fly by the seat of their pants, but they just like, they're like, yeah, we're going to go. I got this idea. It's going to be a cool world. Let's see where it goes. And honestly, like, I've done both ways. I know I think a little bit more now that like the outlining method works for me better, but at the same time,
yeah.
like writing by the seat of your pants is also probably more fun because it's just like, who cares? Let's see what kind of trouble these folks get into kind of thing. So it's all what works for you. It's all about the perspective you bring to the story you're trying to tell, and then if it comes out at the end and it didn't quite work for you, I don't know, go back and do it again with an outline. Or, hey, maybe your outline was garbage, just let it flow the second time around, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's writing. Like, I had a story that I was trying to tell in second person
mm-hmm.
for a long time.
Oh, damn.
I was destined to tell
yeah.
the story in second person.
Really wanted to do it. Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to, and I got all the way through it and gave it to somebody. Did it to a couple writers, and they were looking at it, and they were like, yeah, I mean, I think you're going to learn some things about it once you switch the perspective. And I was like, man, whatever.
Yeah.
You don't know what you're talking about. I'm Dylan. So then I switched the perspective. I went and I changed it from second person to third person.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found was, turns out it's not a very good story. I mean, the only thing that made that story any good was that it was in second person, which is a gimmick.
Yep.
Yeah,
and that's the last thing you want to do
story.
Is like, don't, if you're like a person, it's kind of like the comedian, you know, that has to rely on a gimmick or like they've got that
right.
punchline they use for every joke. And it's like, okay,
right.
that might be cool for one set, but then once everyone's seen it, what has them coming back? You know, like
yeah.
you can't just be a gimmicky, whether you're a writer or an artist or comedian, like you gotta, I don't know, sometimes it just doesn't work. So that's the important thing, I think, is
yeah.
you had that story that you wrote, it didn't quite work together, but you also didn't just disqualify yourself as a writer because of it. It's like, well, that one just hits the cutting room floor and you move on. Like,
yep.
it is what it
that
is.
That one dies.
Yeah, and you just gotta...
But I'm kind of a self-deprecating weirdo, though, because I really enjoyed, like, shitting all over that story. Sorry, I swear. But I really enjoyed, like, shredding that story and saying, like, yeah.
Yeah, you're gone.
Masochism.
Yeah.
I
I kind of do a similar thing with, like, when I'm editing. I really struggle to edit on a screen. I have to, like, print something out and mark it up, like, just really just tear it apart with red ink. Yeah. And then I always have these moments where, like, okay, I've made my outline, or excuse me, I've made my edits on an actual page, and then I sit there and I kind of, like, retype it out with those edits in mind, and then I just shred the hell out of that previous draft. Like, I keep a digital copy around, because especially when you're writing a novel, it's amazing, like, you lose track of, like, what you've included in previous versions of the story, and you're like, oh, I had that really neat scene in, like, draft three that would actually be perfect here now, and you can still dig up the digital copy, but it's like, yeah, just shred that. Shred the garbage ones you wrote along the way, man, because, I don't know, there's something satisfying about that, I think.
Oh, I love killing my darlings. Yeah. That is one of my favorite things to do in writing.
Yeah. It's nice, cause it's a nice release. It's like when you can finally accept that, like, you had this idea you really love, but it just isn't going to come together. Like, when you get over the hump of, oh, but I really like it, and you can just do what's best for the story, that's when things get really satisfying, because it's like, I'm doing the thing that the writer needs to do, not the thing that, like, me as a fanboy of myself wants to do.
Right, yeah. I think that learning to love the editing process, well, I mean, I guess you never really love it, because it's kind of it's the draft part, right?
Yeah.
But learning to love certain things about it, like killing your darlings, like even with Detach, I have it open right now. I'm looking at it, and there are things that I would cut out of the story now.
Yeah, I can imagine.
There's stuff that I would like to. It's so weird. It's like, if I could cut this down to one sentence.
and it's like that writer fear again, you know? Like, I think about that, too, when I get to a point where, let's say I shop, you know, my manuscript around for this particular novel for a year or so, I query my 80 agents, I do some in-person pitching, like, if I don't get any bites, like, I'm into indie publishing, like, that's a thing that I can see myself doing, but then I'm like, oh, God, once I publish it, it's out there, like, that's it then. I can't go back and be like, oh, I suddenly hate this scene and fix it. Yeah. It's just a weird thing to think about.
That's the ultimate writer for this.
Yep, is that you've written something that you're going to hate later.
Well, and that it can't be taken back. Well, and that's one of the most interesting things about the self-publishing world. So I refuse to do it. Mm-hmm. I just refuse to do self-publishing. I don't like what it means for the industry. Not that, I mean, because, like, I love The Martian, right? And mm-hmm. that started as self-published.
Yep.
And so I do think that it has its merits, but I don't like getting on Amazon and looking at a book and I'm like, oh, that's kind of an interesting concept, and then I pull it up and it's little grammatic errors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, you can't, unless you intended to have grammatic errors, you can't have grammatic errors.
Yep. Yeah, and it's one of those things that, too, like, as you kind of dive into the world of, like, independent publishing, like, you do find a lot of stuff where it's, like, it's clear that someone wrote this, they loved writing it, and they just published it because they wanted to get it out of the way, but then it's, like, there are some really quality, there is quality stuff out there, like, you mentioned The Martian, there's Hugh Howey wrote the Silo series, like, Wool was originally written, like, chapter by chapter and published independently, and now that's, you know, Ridley Scott's got the movie rights for that, so it's, like, there can be great stuff out there, but, like, you got to kind of do your research, I guess, too. And, like, you have to be willing to put in, you might have to be willing to bite the bullet and hire a professional editor because, you know, no one wants to be the guy who puts something out there and it turns out that they misunderstood some fundamental grammatical concept that now is playing itself out over 300 plus pages. Like, talk about a writer fear. Like, that's a big thing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say, honestly, if you want to be a writer, you should definitely learn grammar. Yeah. I used to be like, no, you don't need to learn grammar. Grammar's not as important. I don't know why I thought that. It seems like insane to me now. But I think that having command over the tools that you're using. I mean, if you know how to use a hammer, you're definitely going to know how to build something with a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, learning grammar inside and out is the first and best advice I could give to anybody that wants to be a writer.
Yep. And
go
sometimes,
buy William Strunk's book, yeah. Grammar and Style, or what is that? Style and Usage, I can't remember what it's called. But.
Yeah, I feel like I have that on my bookshelf here somewhere, but I don't want to lean too far away. But it's, I mean, it's the one, right? Like, you have to have the essentials down. And part of it is, you can only do so much reading about it before you have to actually sit down and practice writing. But at the same time, like, make sure you know it before you actively publish it or you shop it around for publication. Because, like, you got to have, it sucks to say, but you could have the best idea in the world for a story. You could have a story that's like super enthralling, but I don't know, are you going to put an awesome engine in a car from, you know, 1982 that's all rusted out? No, you're not going to do that. Like, you've got to put that good engine in a good looking car if you want anyone to like pay any attention. So
yeah, definitely.
It's all part of it. It's all part of the process. So.
Gotta have the grammar. Mm-hmm. If you have the grammar, break the rules.
Yeah.
And when you can break the rules, that's when everything unlocks for you. That's why you can go read Jonathan Safran Foer, Mercedes Smith, or just fill in the blank, but they know what they're doing. They know how to break the rules, which is why they can.
And that's part of like what I think for me personally with my process of kind of going back and outlining over and over again and sticking to like, you know, the seven basic elements of, you know, you have your inciting incident, you're going to have a first plot point, you're going to work your way to, you know, a turning point, etc., like those basic things. It's weird to write it because it feels so formulaic. Like, it feels like I've laid myself out and maybe I've boxed myself in, but at the same time, part of me knows that the more comfortable I get with that as a writer, the easier it'll be for me later on to, like, tell that same story again, but by branching off and breaking the quote unquote rules, or it'll just set me up in a better way for like a future project where I can say, okay, I've learned how to use that hammer, so to speak, and now I can build something even cooler with this slightly different hammer.
Right.
Yeah, man, we're stretching the hammer analogies here. We're really, really going for it.
Only stretching hammer so far.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, I mean, if you got a stretchy hammer, it's not going to do you a lot of good. So maybe we'll set the hammer aside for a second here. Let's lay our hammers down and let's maybe hop into, you know, why don't we do it? Why don't we have you read from Detach?
Yeah.
And feel free to kind of set this up for listeners here real quick. And then if you have anything you'd like to say about it before you read it, we'll have you read the piece. And then we can, you know, we'll have a minute or two to kind of chat about that. And then we'll see where things go from there. So.
Cool. Yeah. So this is my piece, Detach. This is the reason why I love this story the most is because it was actually my first one that I ever published.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And it turns out that I published it in like one of the coolest magazines. I didn't know that they were this cool at the time, but they're called Fiction International.
Yep.
Which, I mean, you put it, I'm sure you're putting it in the show notes, but, they're so cool. I mean, I had been chunking the story around forever. I thought it was a perfect fit for Tin House, which is like that's my pie in the sky magazine. Mm-hmm. It's Tin House.
Yeah.
They're absolutely incredible. And, so I was shopping it around. I sent it to all my favorites, you know, Smoke Long, Three Penny, Tin House. I sent it to everything.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it got rejected by everybody.
Yeah, which is always tough, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, at this point, it's like a badge of honor. I have a folder in my email that's called Rejection Letters, where I save all my rejection letters.
Yeah, keep it. It's fuel. Like, it's that fuel. For
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard writers do that, right? I mean, my professor in college, when he was younger, he would nail all of his rejection... Well, not nail, but tack all of his rejection letters to the wall and read them all.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I have mine from my first novel saved up somewhere in a folder. Like, I certainly didn't get rid of that, because it's like, you get so excited when someone's interested at first, but then when they come back and they're like, yeah, it didn't quite work for me, or maybe you don't hear back at all, it's like, all right, well, maybe someone else someday. I'm going to keep that on the side, so, yeah.
Right, right. And so then I see this this one, oh, this reminds me of something cool. So so then I see this magazine on Duotrope that I've never seen before, Fiction International, and it was in their calendar section, which in their calendar section, it has themes.
Mm-hmm.
So like they have this theme coming up. The deadline for this theme is, you know, X date. And their theme was fluids.
Yep.
And I had just recently slightly tweaked and edited Detached to have the word fluids in it.
Yep.
And so then I was like, oh, fluids, interesting. So I clicked on that magazine. And I started reading through, you know, their about, and they've, you know, they published like Joyce Carol Oates and like Malcolm X and crazy stuff
like
that.
That's intense.
So I was like, oh, wow, Fiction International's published cool people. And so I sent it to them, and I was still pretty, pretty bummed about everything, because I was also trying to get into grad school, and I felt like a publication would help me get in, but turns out that's false.
Yeah, sure does. I've been down that road, too. That's a whole other topic for another day.
Yep. So then 19 days later, I still remember, 19 days later, the lady, I can't remember her name now, that's so horrible. She emails me and she's like, yep, we're going to go ahead and put that in our fluids issue.
That's great. That's awesome.
And so, yeah, that was a huge moment for me. I immediately went and bought a bottle of scotch.
Oh, yeah.
And I drank a lot of it.
It was like hashtag Hemingway party, something like that. Yeah,
kind of. And I got super, super annoying for a couple of days, was cool.
But, you know, it's that rush. Like, even you just, like, telling that story gets me all like, oh, yeah, I want that feeling. Give me some of that. Like, I need to mainline that success real hard right now.
Yeah, totally. It's that was pretty great. But then it fades, actually, weirdly.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised at how fast it faded. All it was like, I was like, yes, bottle of scotch, finally. It finally happened. Yeah. I published a 670-word story. And then the next day I was like, okay, well, I'm going to start submitting again. So,
yeah,
this is Detach.
All right.
I asked her what it was like to have a vagina, and she laughed and asked if I had ever tried one on. I told her I wanted to. I wanted her and hers. She was open. She flicked her cigarette off the balcony. I tracked the cherry with my eyes as it fell several stories. Inside the glass door, drunk people were switching fingers and cheekbones and ears with each other. One woman had a leg that was double the length of her own. The leg woman giggled as she leaned against a countertop. She told me that vaginas were pretty and fun. I said it was just that I had never worn one. She said she loved hers and asked if I wanted to try it. I said yes too fast and felt embarrassed. She didn't acknowledge it. She looked around for an opening, and when she thought no one was looking, she stuffed her hand in her high-waist floral shorts. I heard the click of her pelvic button. I pressed the same button on myself. It detached from the base of my anus up to the top of my pelvic bone. She pulled her organ out. The disconnected inner tubing flopped and hung lifeless in front of her face. The tube stripped fluids on our shoes. I felt my eyes open wide when I saw the complexity of hers. Mine only had one tube. We switched and I fumbled with her genitals until they clicked into place. I stuffed the tubing I didn't have connections to into an open cavity. I stood with my legs apart and pondered about how I felt more in tune with color nuances. I felt like people were looking at me. She waited for my reaction and then asked me if I liked it. I tilted my head side to side. I told her that I liked it and that I thought I would have felt completely different, but didn't. She nodded and asked me if I liked it better than my dick, and I laughed and said no. I grabbed her crotch with my back to the door. I asked her if she liked mine, and she nodded. She told me she had tried 7 others. I asked her if they had tried hers, and she said they had no interest. She took out another cigarette. She asked me what my first trait was. I told her about when my brother and I switched hair because I wanted to be sun hair and he wanted to be night hair. I asked her if I could try her eyes, too. She took her cigarette hand off and put it on the balcony before she pushed her eyes into her head and popped them out into her free hand. I did the same, and we blindly exchanged. I blinked a few times and told her she needed glasses. She said she didn't like how they rested on her face, and I said that I understood. I asked her if she wanted them back. She told me that that I could take as long as I wanted. A couple inside swapped heads, and everyone laughed because her long hair framed his broad shoulders. I reached into my pants, and when I noticed her playful face, I blushed. She snorted and told me it was fine. I tested and probed both labia with ginger squeezes. I cupped her vulva with my palm and measured it mentally. A few minutes later, we traded our organs back and I thanked her. She said any time and winked. I told her I would stick with mine for now, and she said it's something that takes getting used to. I asked her what she was doing after the party, and she said she was up for anything. We talked for a few minutes about how maybe, after the party, we could go back to her place and try to switch all of our parts. She asked me if maybe we switched everything but one fingernail, would we still be us? I didn't have an answer.
Awesome. And that is Detached by Dylan Davis. And I gotta say, man, like every time I've read this one a few times, since you first, you know, sent it to me by email in preparation for all of this. And like every time I'm reading it, it's like I get the same experience, but it manifests itself slightly differently. And I just love, like, as we get into the final paragraph of it, it becomes this sort of, I'm just like ready. Like I'm ready for those final lines. Cause there's just suddenly like this change where it's like, we could go back to her place and try to switch all of our parts. And then just like when that point, when the theme, just like the entire idea of it is just driven home in those final two lines about what is, it just drives that theme home really strongly. Like,
right.
How close is our identity tied to who we are physically? And I don't know. I love the way that it ends so open-endedly without being so open-endedly that it leaves someone scratching their head. You know, it's, it really directs one's inner monologue and debate in a way that I think is super, it lands, you know, it's like sticking the landing and the chalk rises up and everyone cheers and you're like, hell yeah, you know, and I don't mean to, I'm not trying to like, you know, give you all this false praise or anything, but like just reading it feels good, you know, because you're going to get yourself in that same mindset of like, I need to evaluate, I'm going to find myself evaluating those themes now, you know, on and off throughout at least the rest of the day, which I think is really great and really part of writing any short fiction is like, you got to hit a theme and it's got to give people something to chew on.
Right. Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much. That's exactly what we were talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
which is like, I set out to make a point and I wanted to leave that person with that point. So, I mean, it starts as a genital trading thing because I was thinking about like what, you know, how our genitals should define us in society, which mm-hmm. they shouldn't, in my opinion. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like the shape of our genitals does not dictate
who we are. Yeah.
And so that started as that, and it felt like the natural progression was to go into the ship of Theseus concept. Mm-hmm. You know, the ship of Theseus concept, it's a Platonic, it's Plato. And he was talking about the ship of Theseus. And so the ship of Theseus is this boat, you know, and one day, one of the boards on the boat breaks. And so they toss that board and they put in a new board. Yeah.
Yep, I have heard of that one, yeah. And at what point what point is it no longer the ship, given that all of these boards have been, you know, replaced
right.
and the hull's been repolished, et cetera? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, is it the ship of Theseus so long as it has one nail? You know mm-hmm. what I mean? And that's where I got the one fingernail thing.
Perfect. That's really cool.
This idea of like these parts trading. Like, what exactly makes us us? Are we just parts? Are we? Is there a soul inside? I
mm-hmm.
don't think so, but that's where I was getting to with this, and the language was to really drive home the point of like to keep you there, which I think is really interesting because I've read the story a couple of times at like coffee shops and open mic nights and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that. I am amazed at the amount of women that walk out on me while I'm reading the story.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you say that because, like, I think about that and I think about my first experience reading it. You know, I opened it up and just started reading it and I was like, oh boy, what have I gotten myself into? You know, because it starts with something that it comes with this sort of idea that, like, it raises a lot of questions, I guess. You know, there's this whole debate about, for some individuals who say that, like, if you are a man or if you identify as a male, you shouldn't even be trying to write, like, female characters because you can't empathize with, like, that experience. And I think that this, like, starts to pull in some of those ideas. I think it starts to pull in, like, a strange sexual connotation to it, even though this is a very non-sexual experience, like, once you actually read
right.
the whole thing. So I can see how it would be, like, really unsettling, but I think that that's kind of the point too. You got to get readers in, and also like if you're really going to explore a theme, you have to explore it through and through. You can't just like dip your toes in it and be like, okay, well, we did it, everyone, you get a participation trophy. Like you've got to be comfortable kind of being uncomfortable. And I think that that's why I was really glad you were willing to read this particular one. And I did think like it was a really good piece to read because it does, I mean, it's tough to hear it at the start because you're like, oh God, what are we getting into? But it's
right.
about that payoff, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Where's this crazy dude taking us? He's
yeah.
talking about vaginas.
Yeah, look
he's
at
talking
this.
About
you're not allowed
what's
to say
on.
The word vagina. That's not allowed at all. I forget what comedian it is that says, maybe it's a Louis C.K. thing, talking about like the differences between male and female nudity and how like, you know, people are just uncomfortable saying the word vagina. But if there's like a naked man, it's like the funniest thing anyone's ever seen. You know,
right,
so
yes,
it's like,
hilarious.
I think if you wrote this from the opposite perspective, it's like you'd get a totally different, I think readers would have a totally different experience. But what I like about it is that it makes you uncomfortable at first, and then you kind of settle into the surreal nature of what you're experiencing. And then it just really, that's the glue that puts it all together, you know?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's awesome that you say that. That's everything that I wanted this story to accomplish.
Well, you did it. You did it for me at least. I can't speak for people that walk out of the coffee shop or anything.
Right,
they should
right.
have stayed back. So it's one of those, like, you know, they say don't judge a book by its cover, but it's also like sometimes you can't judge a short story or especially flash fiction maybe by its opening lines, because it's all about sticking through it and seeing what you can pull from themes in the end. You know, if you're reading something and it makes you uncomfortable, it's not necessarily like,
right.
oh, well, this is bad writing, or it's like, you know, someone shouldn't have done that. It's like, it's supposed to be about why does it make you uncomfortable, and then maybe gives you an opportunity as a reader or a listener to explore that about yourself, you know?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with flash fiction, you're not asking somebody to stay with you for very long.
Exactly.
That's like 3-4 minutes, I
mm-hmm.
think.
Yeah.
So you're saying, okay, just hang out with me for a couple minutes while I put this idea out on the table. And to me, that's like, if you can do that, if you can pull that off with flash fiction, you are definitely going to get it published.
Yep.
And it's just, undoubtedly, with the number of online magazines out there and the number of, you know, that's not why you should do it. You're not trying to get published, but it will happen, I think.
Just got to stick with it. Yeah, stick with it. Write what's on your mind. Don't sugarcoat it, and let it find its home. You know, you got to write the story
yeah.
that needs to be written.
Well, and also this is kind of interesting you bring that up, because like this story was originally going to just be a conversation between two characters,
yep.
right? They were going to be at a party, and he was going to ask her what it was like to have a vagina.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to that moment, first of all, there's no actual dialogue; it's all reported dialogue in the
yep.
story, right?
Yep. Which I think
so,
is aesthetically really cool too. Actually, it adds to the surreal nature of it, so I feel like that was a pretty good choice.
Yeah, yeah. I definitely did it intentionally, there's a couple different reasons why, and I've also noticed that other flash fiction writers do this. They don't take the time to break the story up with dialogue,
mm-hmm.
dialogue tags. They tend to just report it.
Just let it happen, yeah.
Yeah, and so when I got to the moment that it was the operative moment between whether or not they were going to have a conversation or something else is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, well, just go with something. Like, just whatever, the first thing that pops in my head, go with it. And the first thing that did pop into my head was being able to detach, like, literally trade parts.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what really changed the story for me, because it was like, oh, I'd been reading a lot of Russell Edson at the time,
mm-hmm.
and the things that guy can do with flash fiction are just silly. I mean, it's amazing. He has this one flash fiction story. I highly recommend everybody go read Russell Edson if you want to get into absurd
mm-hmm.
Fiction writing. He has this one story that's so great. It's about this dead guy, and his wife is still ordering him around. Like, they're old couple, and she's like, yeah, come on, corpse, you have to get out there and cut the wood.
Oh, God.
It's so funny. It's such a great story.
Sounds like a nightmare, but yeah, I can see how there'd be room for humor in that, too.
Right, yeah. And he just does the craziest things with stories. And when I was reading him, I was like, oh, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know that you could just change the nature of reality
yeah.
to fit a purpose. And so,
I mean, it's like you're writing your own mini fantasy world. It's like, you know, you talk about trying to put together a world for a fantasy novel you want to write. It's like, well, you kind of already did that. You did that with this flash fiction by introducing this concept that is like truly jarring. I mean, it's a really jarring thing to jump into, but by the second paragraph, it's kind of like, okay, I mean, I get it now. Like, sweet, I'm accepting that. My disbelief is totally suspended. Like, it just, you gotta pack it in so tight, you know? And I think that's one of the challenges of writing flash fiction, is like, if you're going to do as something like that, if it's going to be more surreal, you just got to hit someone with it. You know, it is jarring. It is what it is. So.
Well, and you know, in later iterations of the story, I was getting down to the word in terms of editing. Like,
yeah.
Like I was like, okay, search. I heard the click of her pelvic button. Okay. So I heard, listen, saw. And so I was trading single words for a very, very long time
yeah.
on the story before I was like, okay, I think I got it. Which is so funny, because now that I'm reading it, I actually see that there's a Thomas Place, but but it's just actually a slightly older version. So,
but you know, that's part of what it is too. Like, editing at the end of the day, like, you've got to put care into every word. Everything's got to count for something, right? So
yeah, I'm pretty sure the actual published version of the story doesn't have the Thomas Place. I'm looking at the...
You're looking at it now, and it's that moment of, like, looking at something you sent someone or published and going, why did I let myself do that? But
I know it doesn't. I know it doesn't have that comma there. That is definitely the published version. Okay, cool.
Here we are now, sweating about the commas.
Such a small thing. Yeah. But, like, I'm looking at that comma, and I'm like, no.
Crazy. And you can't take it off the page. It's in a PDF. It's too late now. It's too late. That's just part of the experience, but
yeah.
All right, well, awesome. I mean, I feel like we really covered some really good stuff. Thanks a lot for being part of the conversation. It was good to have you on. So thanks for being with me here.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
So there you have it, the R.R. Campbell Rightscast interview with Dylan Davis. I hope you learned something. I know I learned a ton over the course of that conversation. I myself, since having this conversation with Dylan, have signed up for Duotrope. I throw myself into this sort of short story, flash fiction stage that has actually been really productive. I've been really pleased with how that's gone over the course of the last couple weeks as I've tried that out. And if you're a novelist who is struggling right now with your work in progress, maybe you need to shift gears a little bit, hop into that short story mode. It's been really refreshing for me, and I hope it can do the same for you. I've also signed up for Duotrope. Everything Dylan had to say about it has proven itself to be very true. It's a great resource, and I plan on using it to continue to organize my plan, so to speak, for where I'll be submitting some of these short stories after I've taken the time to tinker with them, polish them, and make them everything that I believe that they can be. I want to thank you for listening to the R.R. Campbell Rightscast. We'll have more of these with interviews coming to you on the third Friday of every month. If in the meantime you're curious, you want to learn more, or you want to have access to writing tips, you want to just get in on the conversation in general, you can always follow me on Twitter. I do have a new Twitter handle. I switched it away from the old one. The new handle is IamRRCampbell, so you can follow me on Twitter at IamRRCampbell. You can always hit me up on the actual blog. That's going to be at rrcampbellwrites.com, or you can shoot me an email, and that is rrcampbellwrites@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening, and as always, write on and write.